fasten your seatbelts, and turn up your radio. We're going on a road trip. 2023's first quarter ends today, and we've already seen some crazy things happening to the financial markets. Another interest rate hike, tens of thousands of tech jobs being eliminated, and two major bank collapses that have triggered a global banking crisis, according to the Wall Street Journal. But not all the news is bearish. Stocks have been jumping all over the place the last couple of weeks. Bitcoin is rising again, and mortgage rates are beginning to drop. Our question today is, what does this all mean to you? Welcome to Route 51. I'm Rick Ryer. To help answer that question and more is Kevin McKinley, owner of McKinley Money, LLC, an independent registered investment advisor with offices in Eau Claire and Madison, and the author of the book, Make Your Kid a Millionaire. Kevin, welcome back to Route 51.
Hello, Rick.
Hello, Kevin. Our phone lines are open for your personal finance questions, whether you're thinking about investing, budgeting, estate planning, retirement, or anything in between. Join the conversation by calling us at 800-780-9742. Again, that number is 800-780-9742. Or by emailing ideas at WPR.org. So, Kevin, the Federal Reserve has two problems on its hands, inflation and a banking crisis. Which is worse?
They're both equally bad, Rick. and the bad news is that the remedy to hopefully fixing inflation has actually triggered the banking crisis. So the medicine is, in effect, harming the patient.
So what with all of that, what drove the collapse to the Silicon Valley Bank and Signature Bank and others? Was it negligence?
Negligence is a subject of opinion, but basically what happened with Silicon Valley Bank and to a lesser extent Signature Bank is they took money in deposit, which banks and credit unions are supposed to do. And they took millions and millions and millions of dollars in the Silicon Valley Bank case from local dot-coms and startups that had a lot of extra money that they just needed to park someplace nearby. And then Silicon Valley Bank took that cash and bought long-term bonds with it. And it was a great business when interest rates were low because the bonds were fairly safe. They were long-term, like 10 or 20 years, but they were U.S. Treasuries generally, government bonds, which are about as safe as you can get. And the bank earned about 2% gross on the money and then kind of paid 0% to the depositors. And so on a very scalable business with billions of dollars at stake, that small spread means huge amounts of money. But the problem is that as interest rates rose over the last 12 months or so, as you alluded to earlier with the Federal Reserve raising interest rates, those bonds held by Silicon Valley Bank declined in value and fairly substantially.
So what happened next?
Word got out in Silicon Valley and elsewhere that, hey, that bank where you have millions and millions of dollars of your company's money and you're relying on it to hold it until, you know, payroll comes up on Friday, they might not be able to meet that obligation. And so people actually, much like the 1930s, they lined up to try to take their money out of it, especially the amounts that were over $250,000, because as most people who have that kind of money are aware, that's the limit to which FDIC insurance kicks in for deposits, meaning if you have $250,000 and a bank goes under, you're fine. But if you have $260,000 and a bank goes under, the $10,000 portion above the $250,000 becomes basically a loan to the bank, and you become a creditor to them, and you get in line with everybody else to see if there's any extra month there. And there wasn't enough cash to meet the demand. They couldn't sell their securities at face value, and if they were to sell them at a loss, then they'd really be in trouble. So they needed to basically shut down withdrawals to prevent a run on the bank.
Now, couldn't you have two accounts that are equally less than $250,000? Would both of those accounts be insured?
That's a great question. And the FDIC insurance is really tricky because, like, a person could, in theory, have a checking account for $250,000, and then they could also have an IRA at the same bank and a CD or something for $250,000. And they would have all of those accounts would be insured, even though there was really $500,000 at the bank. You also have a rule in the FDIC insurance where The number of Social Securities involved times $250,000 is the amount of insurance you have. So if you have a joint account, you really have, if it's properly established, you have $500,000 of insurance at that particular bank.
Now, aren't there laws in place to prevent this sort of thing that happened?
You would think, right?
You would think.
Yeah, and in fact, the regulators had been talking with Silicon Valley Bank for quite some time and saying, hey, no offense, but with interest rates rising, your securities values are following, we're not completely sure you're going to be able to meet withdrawals if you get a run on the bank. And it's very difficult. It's kind of like turning a cruise ship around. It's not easy to do. Banks usually aren't nimble. And so when they find themselves in this situation, it's very hard to just stop on a dime, turn around, and fix things right away.
Now, there are some lawmakers that are talking about lifting the FDIC insurance cap. What effect would that have on the economy, and who pays when something goes wrong?
Right. That creates what's known as a moral hazard. And it had to be done for the Silicon Valley Bank because the government basically said, hey, there's millions and millions of dollars at stake here. It's not just all billionaires with their checking accounts here. There are people who are relying on this money for their paychecks in a few days. So for the time being, we're going to insure every single penny at this bank until we sort it all out, to make sure everyone is made whole. The problem with that, of course, is now banks kind of have a free rein to say, oh, well, we can really do whatever we want with our money to try to make as much on it for ourselves and our shareholders as we can. And if it doesn't work out, well, the government will step in and make everybody whole again. So regulators are trying to figure that out. There's been some suggestion that maybe they would raise the deposit limit up to $1 million or something like that. Even that wouldn't have helped Silicon Valley Bank in this situation. They had much more money above that in several accounts. But that's something that's being talked about. I'm not completely sure I agree with it, that it's a good idea to put this backstop in, especially if they're going to keep letting the banks do kind of whatever they want to do in terms of investing it and lending it out.
Now, you mentioned the government stepping in and making things whole again. Who ultimately picks up the tab for bank bailouts?
For the time being, it's actually other banks. Other banks kick in money, both empirically, but also in terms of the FDIC insurance fund. There's probably about $130 billion with a B dollars in the FDIC insurance fund. That it's kind of like an insurance policy that banks pay into to make sure that when this happens, and it does happen, it hasn't happened for a while, but on average, two or three banks a year fail like this. And it's usually during a crisis, of course, so there's more in bad years than good years. But really, it's however they choose to come up with the money to pay for it. It's really the taxpayers who end up coming up with the money ultimately to bail these banks out to kind of keep the system going.
So what are the implications of bank failures for the economy in a broad sense?
It probably is an effective brake on the economy, not slamming on the brakes, but definitely tapping the pedal a bit, because banks now will probably have higher standards of lending and also in terms of what they can do with the money and investing it. The banks are going to, regulators are going to come to the banks and say, hey, sorry, you can't go out and buy 20-year treasuries with these deposits anymore. We ran into a problem. So you have to keep more cash closer at hand. It can't be invested and it can't be lent out to riskier borrowers. And that will probably help slow down the economy a bit, which ironically is one of the Federal Reserve's goals right now.
Now, let's take that to the local level. How does it affect our local community banks or credit unions?
They're going to be less likely to lend money, more so probably for commercial borrowers, like businesses who need money. Usually, when people are talking about mortgages, 30-year fixed-rate mortgages are usually not kept by the lending institution. They're often sold and packaged as investments elsewhere, and they're securitized by sticks and bricks that make up the house. And so there's some asset there as well. So that probably, mortgages won't be affected as much, but commercial borrowing will slow down and banks will have less access, businesses will have less access to capital than they otherwise would have.
Okay. And so now interest rates have been rising and a recession may be looming. What tips do you have for people who are worried about their finances and are wondering where should you put your money during a banking crisis?
That gets tricky, and people hear about banking crises, and they rightfully get really scared about it. It's been worse in history. It's been a lot worse in history, and there are some bright spots in the economy right now. Unemployment is still extremely low. Wages are historically high for most workers right now. And there's some really good ways that people who are in a position to do so can take advantage of the situation.
And for those that are still more comfortable holding on to their cash, what are your suggestions for right now? Where should people be putting their money?
If you're saving money and you haven't checked certificate of deposit rates recently, run to your favorite credit union or bank and see what they're paying on certificates of deposit, because the averages are still very low right now. I think the last number I saw, the average interest rate on a five-year CD in America is still around 1% or so. But there are FDIC-insured banks and NCUA-insured credit unions that are paying over 4% on shorter-term CDs. And so for people who are saving money and have money that they want to kind of keep safe but don't want to don't think they'll need it immediately, a certificate of deposit is a great place to go. And you don't have to, you're not limited to just banks and credit unions. If you have a brokerage account, you can usually buy certificates of deposit at places like Schwab and Vanguard and Fidelity. And actually, the way interest rates are right now, even for people who say, no, I'm comfortable with risk, I just want a higher rate of return, certificates of deposit can be even better than stock funds, even if it's a retirement account and you are a long-term investor.
How much money do I need to put into a CD for it to be effective?
Well, you know, anything you can afford to is better. You know, it's at $1,000 and it's 4%. You pick up $40 in interest and multiply that out if you have more than that. But sometimes some of these banks and credit unions do have conditions where you have to have at least $10,000 or something like that to get the best rate. But it's a fairly democratic situation right now because the banks are trying to compete with each other and bring in deposits. And so they realize they have to pay 3 or 4% on a lot of this money to keep their depositors and bring in new ones.
Now, other options, would you recommend high-yield savings accounts or money market funds or even treasuries, as you talked about earlier?
The high-yield savings accounts, yeah, as long as they're FDIC insured. One of the problems with using a high-yield savings account is if you put money into that, yes, for the time being, you might get 3% or 4%. But at any given moment, if rates drop down or the bank or credit union decides they have enough deposits, they can drop that rate down to zero again, which it was, you know, a year ago. And so if you say, no, I don't really think I'll need this money, you're better off, in my opinion, putting money into a longer-term certificate of deposit, making sure that you get that high yield for the length of the CD term.
Financial advisor Kevin McKinley is here with us taking your money questions at 800-780-9742. Again, that number to call with your personal finance question is 800-780-9742. Or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. I'm Rick Ryer. This is Route 51 on Wisconsin Public Radio. For joining us on Route 51. I'm Rick Ryer. Financial advisor Kevin McKinley is our guest today as we continue our discussion about making the most of your money in 2023 and beyond. What would you like to know? Join the conversation, 800-780-9742. You can send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Kevin, the last time I heard about bank runs was learning about it when studying the Great Depression. Well, the term is back. What exactly does it mean, a bank run? And how likely is it for one of these to happen at my local financial institution?
What a bank run means is that when you put money in, at a bank, the bank just doesn't, unless it's put in a, a safe deposit box, they do stuff with it. They do stuff with it because that's what banks and credit unions are supposed to do. But they also do it because they want to earn money on our money so that they can pay for, the office and employees and free cookies on Social Security check day and all that, and then also provide hopefully some kind of interest to us as well. So that money goes into the institution, but then it goes back out, either in the form of loans or when they buy securities with it. Sometimes they buy a little more esoteric securities, but usually it's just straight up treasuries and maybe some kinds of mortgage bonds and et cetera. And the problem happens, of course, if people say, I am worried about my money and the safety of it. Like Warren Buffett said, it's more important that you get the return of your money rather than the return on your money. And so people go to the bank and they say, I want my money back. Well, it becomes kind of a reenactment of a scene from It's a Wonderful Life where they say, well, your money's not here. It's in this house and it's in this business and it's in this car. And people say, well, I want it right now. And the more people who do it, it makes the problem even worse. And that's typically what it happens is the bank or credit union shuts down and says, I'm sorry, we can't honor your withdrawals right now. Because we don't have enough cash on hand. And there's lots of little liquidity mechanisms in place in the banking and credit union system that allows those institutions to draw from them temporarily until they can sort it out. But when it just becomes overwhelming and the institution realizes that no matter how long they wait, they're not going to be able to fix this problem, that's when the bank actually gets shut down. And it's a very quick process of when the regulators figure it out and they do not give a heads up on it. They say, hey, this bank is closed. This new bank is taking over. Nothing should change for the time being. You're fine. Go back to work.
A little bit ago, we were talking about certificates of deposit, CDs, and you said that you thought that those were safer and better investment than stock funds. And I thought stock funds were really a safe investment for growth. What's up with that?
Well, stock funds are absolutely not safe investments for growth. They're good for growth, but it's kind of like driving on the highway where if you're on the interstate and you're driving 75 miles an hour in the left-hand lane, you're probably going to get to your goal sooner. But in the meantime, you're taking on more risk that you're going to get in a crash and get hurt or hurt someone else or get a speeding ticket. And so if you pull over to the right side of the lane and you drive 60 or 65 miles an hour, it's slower, but it's also safer and it's more predictable. And typically, people who say, I can't afford to risk this certain amount of money and I don't need growth, they chose things like certificates of deposit to invest in rather than the stock market. And I don't have any issue with stock funds, just that people should know what they're getting into when they put the money into stock funds and understand that you have to weigh out the risk versus the reward. In fact, especially when interest rates are in that 4% and 5% range right now, one of the things that this is one of the few things of formulas and content that I came up with myself. Most of these I just borrow, and then in my fading memory, I feel like I came up with it. But this one I know I came up with, and every time I demonstrate it, I think to myself, this can't be right. So I have to go back in and do the math again. And I've done that enough now to know that the math is right on this. So let's say you had two portfolios. You have portfolio A, which is an investment option like a certificate of deposit that pays you 5% per year for 5 straight years. And then you have portfolio B, which pays you 10% per year in 4 out of those 5 years. But in one of those years, and you don't know which year it's going to be, it's kind of like Russian roulette, you're going to lose 15% in the 5th year. Well, most people who can handle risk and are trying to achieve higher rates of return are going to take portfolio B in the form of stock fund investing because they say, yep, I get it, that I can have losses and they can be pretty big, but I like making 10% in 4 out of those 5 years versus only getting 5% in each year. But in fact, after 5 years, you'll actually have more money in portfolio A, the safer one, and you'll have a lot less stress along the way than you will riding the stock market roller coaster.
Less stress is a good thing in my
book. Especially now.
Exactly. Ron from Wolf River has a call. Is a caller with a question for you. Ron? Hello, Ron.
Of their lower interest bearing bonds that they should be replenishing their portfolio with these higher interest rate municipal bonds. Is this a good time? And is that a good strategy to be doing?
Sorry, Ren, so you were saying, thank you for your question. It's a good one. You were saying, should people be using municipal bonds right now?
Yes, in mutual funds.
Yeah, I've used bond mutual funds in the past. I've been doing this for 35 years, and so I'm starting to get the hang of it. And I've used bond mutual funds in the past, but the problem is bond mutual funds generally have all of the bad things about the stock market in terms of risk and volatility and uncertainty, but none of the good things in terms of very high rates of return. So if you have the means and the resources, and it's very tricky unless you have at least, you know, $10,000 or $20,000 to buy an individual security, like an individual municipal bond, that's what I would prefer. But if you don't and you say, no, I'm in a high tax bracket, the 3% or whatever I get on a tax-free municipal bond fund works out to exceed what I'm getting on certificates of deposit, I would say to you, Ron, normally the math works out where high-income people should also have tax-free income investments. But right now, with CDs being 4 or 5%, even paying taxes on that for the amount of risk involved with bond funds, I would much rather have people own individual securities like municipal bonds and especially certificates of deposit than a bond fund.
Great answer. Thank you.
Thanks for your call, Ron. Going to Tim in River Falls. Tim, hi.
Hi, it's Jim. But yeah, thanks for having the program. So I was wondering, I'm retired, but now I have an opportunity. Somebody wants me to work for them, and I think I'd enjoy the job. But my daughter is going to be applying for college, so I'm looking at that, and also I'm my health insurance is through the ACA. So if I go to work and have a lot of my payroll put into like a 403B plan or some sort of an IRA, and that should keep my gross adjusted income lower, I'm assuming. And do you know if they just look for the ACA and for most scholarship opportunities at universities, do they look at gross adjusted income or do they look at some other part of your tax return?
Yeah. What? Let's go first. You got two kind of issues where you have this great benefit. By the way, for people who are sort of retired and they get an opportunity to work, even if you don't need the money, if what you said is true about, hey, I might actually kind of enjoy this, that's a great opportunity, especially if you kind of subtly let your employer know that, oh, by the way, I don't really need this job. You'll get treated much better than when they know that they have leverage over and you need the job and the health insurance. So which one are you more concerned about, the ACA? And for people who don't know, that's what's known as Obamacare, the Affordable Care Act. You can only earn so much money and have so much income before you get you lose the subsidized health insurance premium, and you have to start paying the full boat for it. And there's a big jump once you go over that limit. So you're right to be concerned about it. But are you more concerned about the ACA or the financial assistance for your daughter's college cost?
Well, I guess I thought it was more incremental with the ACA. You know, if you go over a certain amount, yeah, it goes up some. So I guess I wasn't as concerned about that. But like for, I don't know if you've heard of Bucky's Promise, the University of Wisconsin-Madison, yeah, or Wisconsin Promise, which I think Robin Voss killed pretty much for the other state colleges. But that, I know if you hit a certain level, like $63,000 or something like that, it's out completely. You just can't enroll in that program anymore.
Right. And that's something you have to weigh out, is the value of your extra income. You know, are you looking at a job where you'd make, you know, $60,000 or $70,000 a year, or is it more like $10,000 or $20,000?
Well, I think it would be like $50,000, but my wife got called back to, I mean, there's a lot of need for work, so my wife got called back to a community college, too, to fill in. So between the two of us, I'm just wondering, you know, if we put a lot of that into an IRA, if that is looked at for either of those programs, or if that, you know, if it's not.
Yeah, it's tricky to hide that income for certain types of income sensitive, because people get it and say, hey, no offense, but you hid this income for our formula purposes. It's not like you buried it in the hole in the ground or something. So just go with each one, and you might find that your income would qualify you for the Bucky's Promise tuition program for your daughter, but it might preclude you from getting ACA. And then, of course, they change those numbers and they change those programs every single year. So if you're going to make a significant amount of money, that can offset any loss that you have from this. And if it's a job you like, I'd say take the job. But I would also say be very cautious if you say, geez, I've done the math, and between what it's going to cost from potentially lost college assistance for my daughter and then also for having to pay higher health insurance premiums, it's just not worth it. Sometimes people will weigh the number out and go, you know what, I'm going to net out about $6,000 extra for this job. It's not worth it for $6,000. It's definitely worth it for $50,000.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Jim, for calling in to Route 51. You can join the conversation as well, 800-780-9742. Again, that number is 1-800-780-9742. You can email your question to Kevin McKinley at ideas@wpr.org. Kevin, there may be some listeners who may be having a hard time splitting their income between spending, paying down debt, and investing. How can they prioritize these goals?
Yeah, for people who are working, it's really tricky to say how do we make the numbers work, first of all? What's the smartest place to put money? But then also, how do we make sure that we just don't slave away for 40 years of work and then cleverly die at 62 without having any fun? So what I'd recommend is you start first by building up an emergency fund. And that should be at least 3 months' worth of your typical monthly expenses. And that's a good idea because that's how long, even in this kind of environment, that people are unemployed for until they get a similar job back again. And so not only does it mean that you build up an emergency fund for any kind of emergencies or loss of income, but it forces you to calculate what I feel is the most important figure in investing and saving and retiring, and that's what you spend every single month. And a lot of us don't like to do it. It's kind of like stepping on the proverbial scale, but it tells you where your money's going, and you might also see some places that you can cut back. And if you happen to be in a relationship with another person, whether it's a domestic partnership or married or whatever, you have good news because you have a person there who's been dying to tell you where you can cut back on your spending, and we'd be more than happy to go through your figures and say, this is a waste, this is a waste, this is a waste for it. So after you built up that emergency fund of 3 months of your monthly expenses, then start paying down high-interest credit card debt, and that not only saves you money on the interest, but it also can save you money on your insurance premiums, like your car insurance, because your credit score will go up, and it means that you'll be able to borrow money cheaper in the future when you do choose to do it, like buy a home or buy a car. And then it leaves room for emergencies on the credit card. So when the car breaks down and it's $3,000 to repair the transmission or whatever, you've got at least one place you can go right away to get the car fixed and then worry about paying off the credit card later. And only after you do those two things, that's only when I would start worrying about longer-term goals like saving for retirement.
And there's quite a few options in saving for retirement. Where should somebody start?
Yeah, the younger you are, the less financially secure you are. And by the way, if you're 28, 38, whatever, and you're hearing all these big numbers thrown around and you say, I'm never going to get there. I don't even know how people ever got that kind of money. Well, there's a lot of 58 and 68 and 78-year-olds who are saying, yep, I used to think that too, and kind of by luck and kind of by hard work, we're actually okay. So don't feel bad. You will get there. We've all been in that negative net worth situation at some point in our lives. And if you're in that situation, and you want to save for retirement, the best opportunity is the Roth IRA. And for 2023, you can contribute $6,500 or your earnings, whichever were less, or $7,500 if you will admit to being over 50 years old. You do not get a tax deduction on the contribution to the Roth IRA. But if your income's low enough, you might get a saver's credit that can be worth up to $1,000 for a single filer and up to $2,000 for married filers on their taxes. When you put the money into the Roth IRA, any future investment earnings are sheltered from taxation. And then when you retire after age 59 and a half, you get to pull all the money out tax-free. But the reason why I love the Roth IRA for people who are maybe not quite comfortable yet financially is that you can pull the contributions to the Roth IRA out at any time for any reason. And there are no taxes and no penalties on that withdrawal. Meaning if you put $1,000 into a Roth IRA And then 3 years from now, you go, shoot, I need that money. You can pull $1,000 back out at any time for any reason with no taxes or penalties whatsoever. And as long as you keep the earnings stay remaining in the account, you won't have to worry about taxes or penalties.
Sam and Weston sent an email asking, how do you feel about interest rates on CDs as compared to possible inflation rise, which would potentially defeat the gain? In which case would that make hard assets like gold worthwhile?
You know, there's a huge decades or centuries long reason to own things like gold, but it's really more of a hedge. It's kind of almost an insurance policy against rapid inflation or hyperinflation, and most people are not in a position where they need that kind of hedge, nor will they benefit it for or have even the money to take advantage of it. So it's nice because it feels good to have some Krugerrands, and especially if you're, you know, a history major or history buff and you've heard about things 100 years ago where there's been, you know, financial panics that have destroyed governments. The gold sometimes just feels good to have buried in a hole in your backyard. But in terms of using it as a hedge, you know, inflation is high right now. But for most people, it's not as bad. It's just it's a pain that's worse in feeling than it is in the actual, because it's something that we go to the gas station and we pay $4 a gallon for gas, or we pay $4.59 for a dozen eggs or whatever. That's really real. But in terms of the big scheme of things, most expenses aren't rising at the rate of these very near expenses like a gallon of gas. And so it's not as bad as what you think. And I really like the safety of CDs and getting some good return on it in terms of trying to take greater risk on the money and having either giving up liquidity or losing the money or both.
You're listening to Route 51 on Wisconsin Public Radio with our guest, Kevin McKinley. A discussion about making the most of your money and making sound financial investments for the future. I'm Rick Reier. This is Route 51 on Wisconsin Public Radio. This is Route 51 on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rick Reier. Financial advisor Kevin McKinley is our guest today as we continue our conversation on smart money management. You can join the conversation, too. Email ideas at WPR.org or join us by phone at 800-780-9742. Kevin, at the beginning of the program, I mentioned mortgage rates are starting to come down. In addition, nationally, existing home buying is up over the past 2 months. Most people would see that as good, but not the Federal Reserve. Why is that?
Well, the Federal Reserve has a bigger mandate than making housing more affordable, and that's, you know, managing inflation and unemployment. And so sometimes there's some collateral financial damage, and one of them is that mortgage rates have risen a lot, making homes less affordable, not because prices have increased that much, but all more so just because the payment is higher with that higher interest rate.
And that said, is it still a good time to buy or sell a home, or is that ship sailed?
It's a great time to sell a home, depending on the area in which you live. You know, we've seen some small decreases in home prices, especially in the Midwest, because we didn't have the big run-ups that they did on the West Coast. And with people moving, you know, having more work-from-home opportunities, they've kind of gravitated towards warmer places or cheaper places or whatever. But the fact of the matter is that home construction and new homes just are not rising fast enough to meet the demand. So you shouldn't judge a home purchase by just by interest rates. You should judge it by when you think you're going to be in a certain place for at least 5 years And you should also be thinking about, when you do the location, is what will our life look like 5 years? Like, if you're a young couple starting out and you say, well, we don't have kids right now, but in 5 or 10 years we might, and we would like to send them to a local school, you probably want to purchase your home in a school district that fits your needs. And so one of the, you know, if you talk to your parents and they're more than willing to tell you about their history of home buying, they actually made their money by buying homes when mortgage rates were 8 or 9 or 12%, and then refinancing every time interest rates dropped down and it made sense to do it. And the cool thing about a 30-year fixed rate mortgage is that you don't have to pay it off any sooner than 30 years if you don't want to, but you can refinance it at any time. And so what you'll find is, if more, you know, a lot of people who are looking for a new home or their first home are, you know, on their knees praying for lower mortgage rates. Well, what will happen when that happens? And it will happen, but home prices will jump enough to offset that. So you're better off looking at for the home that you need and that's right for you right now and getting into it, and then saying, if rates go back down again, then you can refinance it, and you'll find you'll have probably an increase in home equity as well, because the value has increased, which should also help you be able to refinance the mortgage too.
Well, what about investing in your existing home? Is now a good time to borrow against home equity?
It is for certain people. If you're cash strapped and you say, do we really need to do this? And especially if it's something that's not cosmetic, but you're just making the place better. You know, when you put in $20,000 into your home, let's say, you usually don't get that $20,000 back right away in increased value, but you do get 60 or 70% of it back in increased value. And the difference is often, can be an intangible benefit because you enjoy your kitchen that much more. Don't go crazy with it. Be smart. Be structural. Don't put in a swimming pool, and definitely don't borrow the money to put in a swimming pool. But you can remodel it and say, this is something we can afford, and we really have to do it now because you never quite know when the worker is going to be available, when the materials are going to be available. We have a lot of clients who I said, you know, how's the kitchen remodeling going? And they say, well, it was going good, but we had to stop. And I said, why? And they said, well, because we're trying to install a dishwasher, and there's a special screw that is only made by a factory in Ukraine that doesn't exist anymore. And so we have to wait for that special part to come in before we can continue with everything else. So when you have the time and the brain space and the resources, even if you do have to borrow a home equity loan, it's a good idea to move on with those projects because it may never be easier or cheaper in the future.
What's the general rule of thumb for calculating how much house you can afford?
Well, the bank will tell you that you have to have a payment that's roughly about, you know, 28% to a third of your gross monthly income. And sometimes for some people, that's enough. For other people, that's actually too much. And so as a rule of thumb, you should be able to say, hey, we're going to hopefully be able to get by with only spending a quarter to a third of our gross monthly income on all housing expenses. And that's not just the mortgage payment. That's property taxes and insurance. And if you're buying a condo, that includes the condo fee, et cetera. So try to keep it at a quarter to a third of your gross monthly income. If you make $4,000 a month, you should try to keep your overall housing costs to somewhere between $1,000 to $1,200 or $1,300 per month.
We're going to get back to retirement savings in just a bit, but I wanted to read you an email from Paula. Her question is, what do you think about investing in savings bonds right now?
My all-time favorite investment is Series I savings bonds, Series I, and the I stands for inflation. These are issued by the United States government. You can go to the website at treasurydirect.gov, and they have a link that you can find for Series I savings bonds. And these are really cool because you can get in for a very low dollar amount, like $25. The interest rate right now, and this is good for 6 months if you purchase today, is 6.88%. And that interest is exempt from state taxes. So if you live in a state with higher state income tax rates, that's like getting 7 or 7.25%. And that interest rate changes every 6 months, every May 1st and November 1st. So you'll get a new interest rate on that. And the interest rate can go as low as zero, but it is tied to inflation. So it's a very good inflation fighter. The bad news is that you shouldn't put any money in there that you might need in the next 12 months because it's very difficult to get back out within the first year. But after 12 months, there's only a penalty of 3 months' worth of interest on any withdrawal. So you only lose 3 months' worth of interest if you pull the money out after 12 months. And after 5 years in these bonds, there's no penalty at all for it. It's technically a 30-year bond, but you can get it out after 5 years with no penalties at all. The other bad news is that you can only buy $10,000 per person per year. You can't buy them in an IRA or a Roth IRA or a 401k. And the treasurydirect.gov website, as many listeners are just finding out right now, is better than it used to be, but it's still terrible. And so it's really difficult to navigate, especially to set up the account. You have to link it to a bank or credit union account to have the funds electronically transferred in it. Once you get the account set up, it's pretty easy to navigate and make future purchases in. But you should, you know, take a rainy Saturday like tomorrow and say, all right, I'm going to spend a few hours getting this account set up, and then I'm going to deposit some money in there.
Okay. There are a lot of baby boomers out there eyeing retirement seriously. How do you know if you're set financially for retirement? In other words, how can you retire without running out of money?
Right. How do you make sure your money lasts at least as long as you do? Yeah,
yes.
That's the question I wake up thinking about every single morning as for my grown-up job here. And I actually, we have, I think, four different software programs that we use to do all the calculations and enter the numbers in. And after printing out 100-page reports that all kind of said the same thing, I kind of figured out that, like a lot of software programs, this is more about trying to baffle people with BS than it is about providing useful answers. So I came up with a simpler, better formula for calculating not only how much you need to retire, but also how much you can spend each and every month. And it only involves one unknown variable, and that's how long you expect to live.
So tell us, what's the formula?
You take all of your liquid savings. This would be any paper statement that you get that has a dollar sign on it, like your checking account, your investments, and your retirement accounts, and then divide that total by how many months you think you're going to live. And once you get that result from your calculation, that's how much you can spend this month. And then you do the same thing 30 days from now for the next month.
Okay. I'm not a mathematician, Kevin. You know that. So give us some real numbers. How does it work?
There's a reason they call you the Wisconsin Public Radio eye candy, Rick. And that's okay.
Thank you.
That's what you're good at. That's your strength. That's your superpower. Yeah, let's say you're retired. And again, this is one of those figures that's going to boggle the mind of some younger people. But let's say you have $600,000 in liquid assets and you're 65 years old and you think you're going to live to 90. Well, that's 25 years or 300 months. So divide your $600,000 by 300, and that gives you $2,000 per month that you can spend this month. And then next month, make the same calculation.
Okay, $2,000, that doesn't seem to be that much.
No, it's not, but most workers and people who have been able to accumulate that kind of money have Social Security, and a few have a pension aside there. And if you're getting, you know, let's just say you're getting $2,000 for Social Security and then you have your $2,000, that's $4,000 total per month, which is about the average household spending for retirees across America. And the reason that I like predicating that amount on your spending is because it shows you the damage of loss, meaning that if you take too much risk and you lose $100,000, the monthly spending figure goes down substantially versus the benefit of the gain. And it also shows you how much you can give to family or charity now versus later. And this is the bigger issue, and I know it is because I know Wisconsin Public Radio listeners very well. Even the ones who are financially independent and have accumulated more money or security than they ever thought, they still have this Depression-era raised parent or grandparent in their ear saying, I can't believe that, you know, that you drive a $30,000 car, or you have a cabin, or you went on vacation, and they have a really difficult time spending the money. So doing this calculation allows people to free up spending that they can afford to do. For instance, like let's say you say, well, gee, we have a $10,000 vacation coming up, but we're retired. We just can't feel good spending that kind of money here. Take your $600,000, deduct that $10,000, and divide the $590,000 by your 300 months of life expectancy. And instead of $2,000 a month, now you can spend $1,966 per month. So in actuality, the $10,000 vacation really only cost you about $33 per month over your retirement. And for most people, that case say, oh, well, I'm going to cut my cable bill out and I'm going to take the trip.
Now, that's a good way to look at it. Now, you mentioned risk. When is it appropriate to take investment risks, and or when should I play it safe?
You should play it safe with money that you think you're going to need, or when you say, hey, I have more money than I do need. I did your calculation, Kevin, and I actually have more money than I think I will spend. Therefore, I don't need to take any risk for it. Or when the opportunity for very long-term growth presents itself, meaning that you're 20 or 30 years old and you're saving money for retirement in a pre-tax plan like a 401k or a 403b, you're probably not going to touch this money or even need it for 20 or 30 years. And then even when you do retire, you're not going to spend it all the first day of retirement. You're going to slowly withdraw it over hopefully 20 or 30 more years. So you might have a 40 or 50 year time window. That's when people should invest in stock mutual funds and index funds and things that are going to provide more risk, but hopefully more return as well.
We have an email question. With bank bailouts on the horizon, are they really safe investment? And are they affected when the government raises the debt ceiling?
Well, yes, I'm in a permanent state of paranoia for my clients and their financial situation. It's my job, really. And even with that constant state of paranoia, I'm very comfortable in depositing in FDIC-insured accounts at banks and NCUA-insured accounts at credit unions. I feel very good about that. The debt ceiling is something that's just, it's performative, all the discussions about it, it's going to happen sooner or later. And so that's not going to have a huge effect on what's going on with it. Higher interest rates might, just because if you put money into a certificate of deposit now at, let's just say, 4%, then all of a sudden interest rates go to 6%. If the money's at a bank or credit union, you probably have to pay a penalty to pull it out and then move it across the street or even keep it at the same institution to get that higher rate. But there's a calculation you can make that says, oh, I had a 4% CD. I now can get a 6% one. If I pay the penalty, which is usually about a year's worth of interest, will it be worth it to take it out, pay the penalty, and move it? And that's a pretty simple calculation to make.
We have just a couple of minutes left. Kevin, how do you see inflation headed? Where do you see it headed in the next number of months or years? Will it be safe to buy eggs again soon? Or will I need to take out a mortgage?
Take out a mortgage or get your own chicken coop, right? I think it's actually, if you think inflation and interest rates are going to rise, it's a good time to take out a mortgage because you can hopefully lock in that rate for 30 years. I see inflation going higher just because it's going to be very difficult to solve the intractable problems of labor and of labor availability and supplies, et cetera. And a lot of inflation is generated by demand with people with money looking to spend it. But I am very concerned about the economy in the very short term. In the very long term, we're all dead.
That is true. What right now, what is the easiest, the simplest thing somebody can do if they have that extra cash that they, you know, whether it's an investment or something else?
If they're working, the best thing to do is use that cash to cover expenses while you raise up your deposit to an at-work retirement plan like a 401k or a 403b. Or if you're not eligible for those, make an IRA contribution. Because if you have earned income and you make a deposit into a pre-tax retirement plan, you get an instant guaranteed rate of return that's equal to your overall income tax rate. So if I'm paying, let's say, 20% in taxes, and I put $1,000 extra into my 401k, that saves me $200 in taxes right now. And so use that savings to offset the extra $1,000 that you put into the retirement plan in the 401k. And what happens is that actually cuts your spending down because it reduces your paycheck, which, again, is the key to all things when it comes to financial independence.
And in the remaining minute and a half, Kevin, what else do you have to advise us with?
Yeah, I tell people one of the things that when we go through the process of figuring out where their money should be invested and where they should put any new money, a lot of people come up with, well, I want to save money for my kids' college. And that's a very noble and understandable priority, but it's not something that I would put ahead of building up your emergency fund, paying off credit card debt, or saving for retirement, because you can borrow money to pay for college, but you can't borrow money for retirement. So do not make, if you're strapped financially, do not make saving for your kids' college your top priority. Only do it if you just say, we have so much money left over, we don't know what to do with it.
Kevin, thank you so much for joining us today on Route 51.
Spend less, have more.
Kevin McKinley of McKinley Money LLC in Eau Claire and Madison. Our producers today are Joy Ratchkramer, Shireen Seward, and Kate Springer. We also have in technical support from Liz Domes. Joy is also our on-air producer today. Special music today from Pink Floyd, The Kinks, Stevie Wonder, and Dire Straits. Thanks to John Altenberg for the Route 51 theme. You can hear the archive of today's program at WPR.org/Route 51. Join us next week for another fascinating ride along Route 51. Until then, we're headed out of town.
Way you do it, you play the guitar on the end.